show. It's the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And this week, a special show, actually. A lot of it's going to focus up around Ferguson, but it's going to focus up around, actually, I guess the theme is sort of like, there's upheaval rocking the world. And damn, it's about time, man. At the back end of the show, we'll be hearing from Bill Quigley, law professor at Loyola University in New Orleans and associate legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights for quite some time. He's going to be talking about 10 illegal police actions to watch for in Ferguson and all the time, anytime that you step out to stand up against the power. Before that, we'll be talking with Larry Everest, a writer for Revolution Newspaper who has been down in Ferguson since just before the decision, the whitewash decision to not indict the cop that murdered Michael Brown was brought down. And Larry's still down there now. And we'll also be talking with Amina from the LA Revolution Club, talking about what's been going on in Los Angeles and what's still to come. All right, so that's a great one. But opening the show up, I'm very happy to be doing this segment. For a while now, Mexico has been just in total upheaval, and the horrors that were going on down there, but then also the inspiration of what happened when people stood up, and taken to the streets and really rocked the world. And it's very important that people pay attention to this. And I was reading something in the LA Times, a piece that I came across that was, it was an op-ed piece recently, and it really struck me as something we need to talk about. It's by Ruben Martinez. And Ruben is a professor of literature and writing at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. He is the author of Desert America, A Journey Across Our Most Divided Landscape. And he spent some time in Mexico recently in the midst of all this. And he's written a very moving piece about it, and he said that there's the outrage over 43 students feared to have been massacred in September by drug gang hitmen working in cahoots with corrupt police has constituted the biggest crisis to President Peña Nieto's administration since he took office in 2012. Ruben, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Michael. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. Well, the thing that actually got me really, really heavily in what you said in your article, in your op-ed piece, You described the disappearance and murder of the 43 students as causing a political earthquake not seen in generations, perhaps since the revolution of 1910. Explain what you're talking about there. How does that show up?
Well, we're talking about a war now that was declared in 2006 by former President Calderón in Mexico. It's not like the crisis hit a couple months ago with the disappearance of the 43 students in Guerrero, but what occurred in the last 2 months as a result of that case really galvanized the population in a way that hadn't been seen since the beginning of the conflict. The revelations of the collusion between government at all levels, federal, state, and local, with police at the local level, with the political class, both, and it has to be said, on the left, the center, and the right. Basically, this one case wraps everything together in an indisputable way. There's evidence that the entire political class and the army and the police forces were all in it together with the narco cartels. So we're reaping, really, the fruits, the terrible fruits of the war on drugs, which we declared on this side of the border, but which, of course, is a transnational conflict. And the disappearance of these 43 students just kind of brings it all together in a way that rocked Mexico. I mean, everybody had the sense that this collusion was a fact of daily life. But here, it was just presented to us in an indisputable way. And the way I described it in the piece was that there was a press conference that was held on November 7th by the Attorney General of Mexico, Jesus Murillo Caram. And in that press conference, he basically laid out the evidence in such a way that really, really hit people emotionally in a way that I describe as being kind of like the way we felt up here, either with 9/11 or Sandy Hook or going back a couple generations, Kent State, that type of kind of like emotional gut-level reaction, or Ferguson, you know, right now, to go no further than that. So Mexico's in that space right now, emotionally and politically, and we're seeing a huge civil society movement that's rising up as a result of it.
You know, one of the things that you talk about, too, and you just mentioned it as you were speaking, the point that this is the entire ideological spectrum of the political class is tainted. And I was thinking about that. You know, I was in Mexico for a little while during the Chiapas uprising, and the whole thing there of the presence of the PRD, the Party for the Democratic Revolution, and the presence there of that being sort of a, well, this is the left hope and all this stuff for a lot of people. But even that, you point out, is like, that has been just as exposed as every other party in Mexico and in the ruling classes of Mexico. That's been exposed to something that people can't put their hope in.
Yes. And the political earthquake has occurred within the PRD, the leftist party of the Democratic Revolution, which Demo Cárdenas was the founder of way back in 1988, when pretty much everybody agrees he was robbed of the election to the presidency. And he just resigned from the PRD as a result of the scandal which has tainted the party. Because in Guerrero, the small town of Iguala, where the 43 students are from, it was the mayor and his wife who were the instigators of this forcible, violent disappearance, which in all likelihood results in their deaths. There's no absolute forensic evidence just yet, but we've pretty much given up hope that they will be found alive. It was the mayor and his wife that were the instigators of this forcible disappearance, and they are members of the PRD. And pretty much everybody agrees that if you've got, you know, a mid-sized city mayor and his wife of this party in Guerrero, which is known as a leftist stronghold in the country, tainted, you know, with corruption, then there's got to be a lot more. And top leaders of the PRD are resigning left and right, which, look at the optimistic side of it, it opens up a space in Mexico for a brand new political force. That's not necessarily beyond ideology. I don't think you can get beyond ideology ever, right? But there is a fresh face now to progressive forces in Mexico. And it, once again, it didn't happen overnight. A couple years ago, there was the Yo Soy 132 movement that started at the Catholic University in Mexico City, which was really unlikely kind of, you know, a place for it to happen. Like a relatively conservative, apolitical student body. The year of the presidential election that brought Peña Nieto to power, there was a student uprising that began on that campus and quickly spread nationwide. It kind of tapered off. Peña Nieto won the election, but has come back, or rather was kind of like a stepping stone to what we're seeing today. And so there really is a new political voice coming up that is not coming top down, but is rather going from bottom up. And it's joining students, middle-class students, working-class students, to NGOs, to the people who feel that they haven't been represented by anybody in the political class. Just everyday Mexicans are turning out on the streets and marching. And I happen to have had the privilege of being on the streets of Mexico City last Thursday when something like 100,000 people turned out to march. And it was one of the most inspiring moments I've seen in the midst of this darkness.
I'm going to ask you about that in just a minute, but I wanted to pursue something that you were saying about how this crisis actually has opened up a certain door, you know, to a different future in a certain sense. You know, and one of the things that's really happens a lot in these kinds of situations that are brewing revolutionary situations, where the legitimacy of state power comes into question very sharply, and especially the legitimacy of their use of armed force. And you seem to be saying in your piece that basically that was one of the big questions that actually focused itself, particularly because the victims this time were completely innocent people.
Completely. Absolutely. And by the way, I'm so glad to be on Pacifica KPFK with you and hear the word revolutionary, right, said unironically or without casting aspersion, right, on a movement. And it's true. Mexico right now is in, I don't know the exact technical, you know, political science term might be a pre-revolutionary moment, but it's right on the cusp of something really, really big. Certainly the state's power has been shaken. Its moral authority has been dealt a really super strong blow. The presidential terms in Mexico are 6 years long. Peña Nieto is 2 years into his, right? And it's really an open question as to, right now, I think, really, as to whether he's going to finish that term, precisely because how is he going to get back the moral authority that he's lost when his very government, the army that's supporting him, is tainted by human rights scandals left and right? So we have that. And you point to the students and their innocence. Absolutely. That's one of the main reasons that people have been so galvanized. During the Calderón administration, the previous presidential administration, at the beginning of the conflict, there were several massacres. This is not the first massacre. There's been dozens and dozens and dozens of these. Mass graves have been found throughout the country, especially in the rural areas. And Calderón often tried to dismiss the political questions that arose, calling into question his prosecution of the drug war, by saying, oh, well, if they're in a mass grave somewhere, that must be because they were with the narco cartels. In other words, they deserved it, right? They deserved their fate in one way or another. The students of Iguala, by every single account, were completely innocent, had no connection whatsoever to the cartels. They were activist students. Guerrero is famously a stronghold of revolutionary ideals. In the 1970s, there was a powerful peasant rebellion there, and that continued, and that tradition continues to this day. If you look at the pictures online of the school, that the teachers' college that the students attended, you'll see, you know, murals of Che Guevara and revolutionary slogans everywhere. And there's also the sense that this kind of repression has been targeted precisely at revolutionary forces in Mexico. A lot of innocent people have been swept up, certainly, and it looks like the government slash cartels, because that's the way you have to think of it now, right? You can't think of them as separate, have been trying to disarticulate people's movements across the nation. So there's a political angle to the violence as well.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Ruben Martinez, a professor of literature and writing at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. He's the author of Desert America, A Journey Across Our Most Divided Landscape, and a number of other books and pieces. And people should really check out the op-ed piece that Ruben wrote recently in the LA Times. It's called Americans Ignore the Mass Murder of Students at Israeling Mexico. It's well worth reading and thinking about, a lot in it to really sort of stick pins in your brain and make you jump up and think, all right? Now, Ruben, one of the things that I wanted to talk about, this is really heavy, man. It's really very interesting. I'm really following what you're saying and appreciating it deeply. You know, one of the things you mentioned, that you were in Mexico just last week and being part of the demonstrations down there. Talk about what this is. How does this look now in Mexican society, the society-wide upheaval and struggle? What's it look like?
One of the amazing things about the march on November 20th, which was the largest of three mass marches there's been since the crisis hit on September 26th, Thursday, November 20th, happened to be the anniversary of the Mexican Revolution of 1910. And so there's always an official government celebration of that day in Mexico. It's a pretty big deal. And in the Zócalo, the big public square in Mexico City, there was these decorations, including these kind of like light murals, you know, made up with little lights creating figures. And two of the biggest figures on the plaza, massive figures, were the faces of Pancho Villa and Emiliano Zapata looking down on the plaza. Now, these figures were being used by the PRI, the party in power, right, the corrupt party in power. But clearly, the people on the streets were trying to, you know, take those revolutionary figures back. What I saw on the streets was, as I was referring to earlier, a tremendously expansive coalition of people. There was actually three marches that converged together on the Zócalo, coming from different places in the city. There was peasant organizations, there was urban labor unions, there were student groups, there was NGOs, human rights organizations. The march that I was part of, you know, walked 2 miles or so, and people were just pouring out of the office buildings on Paseo de la Reforma, which is kind of like the Wall Street of Mexico. People were pouring out of the office buildings, you know, middle-class people, bureaucrats, everyday Mexicans. So by the time we reached the Zócalo, it really was representative of civil society. We, you know, we throw that term around, civil society. It's become kind of cliche, kind of like an empty term, really. It's a faceless term. But the face of Mexico was in that plaza. And the only people that spoke the entire time, this is really important to point out, were the family members of the disappeared students.
Wow.
That's the moral voice behind this movement. There's no career politician involved. There are activists, of course, involved, right? But they're not taking the stage. They're allowing, really, the people's voice to be heard. In this case, the voice of victims of the violence. And that's where the great moral authority of this movement comes from.
Mm-hmm. One more question, Ruben. The question that you keep coming back to in your piece, you keep coming back to, why is all of this being ignored by so many in the U.S., which is a very important question to jump into right now, I think.
Yes. Well, you know, on the one hand, we do have a lot going on, right? We've got Ferguson going on, and that's huge, right? So we're going through kind of like an internal reckoning right now. That's a huge historical moment for us in the United States. But I've seen a lot of people in Mexico hashtag Ferguson alongside Ayotzinapa, which is the name of the town where the rural school where the students disappeared is. So hashtag Ayotzinapa, hashtag Ferguson, right there together. How can you put those two places together? In a simple word, impunity. The police acting on the behalf of a corrupt state and trying to disarticulate people's movements, ultimately. So you can look at this as, in the deepest possible sense, as being ultimately the same struggle. And I will say this, because it's the drug war that we're talking about. The violence exists right now in this way because of the drug war that we prosecute as the United States. And it's a transnational situation, and the only solution is a transnational one. We do have a movement for legalization with building momentum, right, over the last few years. California, more than likely, in a couple of years, will legalize too. That's helping. But right now, the Obama administration has kept the status quo in place, is supplying aid to Mexico, to the federal government and the army, that is tainted by human rights abuses, oftentimes against not just innocent victims, but also people's movement, people involved in the people's movements down there. So we have a transnational situation that cries out for transnational activism and in some way for us to recognize that our struggles are won. Hashtag Ayotzinapa, hashtag Ferguson.
All right, Ruben, very important point to end on. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me.
Yeah, and stay in touch, man. I'd like to follow this up with you as much as you start writing about it and other things you're doing as well, all right?
Right on. Take care.
All right, man. Take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've just been talking with Ruben Martinez, a professor of literature and writing at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. He's the author of Desert America, A Journey Across Our Most Divided Landscape. That's his most recent book, and he's got just tons of other writings and pieces that you should check out, all right? We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. Actually, it's going to be a little bit more of an extended musical break, and we'll be right back with Larry Everest and then a little later, Amina from the LA Revolution Club.
You die a slave.
Don't you die, don't you die a slave.
No matter what you do,
no matter what you do.
Don't you die a slave.
Don't you die a slave, never, never.
No matter what you do,
no matter what you do. No.
Don't you die a slave.
My. Rest in peace. Killing all my brothers off is all they can do. All our brown skin backs is up against a single wall. Like we're meant for nothing better than catching a goddamn ball. Get a load of the worldwide military and police. Making these young lives cease while we still beg for peace. For too long we've been subjected to this type of cruelty. War is wrong, it's sucking the very life and soul out of me. But I won't die a slave, no. As the authority enslaves us, we learn to enslave ourselves. Because authority represents success and wealth. The authority can kill us with no value of our life. For wealth and to be nearer to the authority, we'll kill ourselves and have no value of our life. This is why the outrage swells when they kill a brother like Ezell.
When they kill a brother like Mike Brown. When they kill a brother like Jordan Davis. When they kill a brother like Tony Cooks. Or when they kill a brother like Ezell.
No matter what you do, don't you die a slave.
I got pulled over at a routine traffic stop. Nothing wrong, I was just dealing with a racist cop. He asked what's in my car, if he could search or not. He got the dogs on me, when is we gonna make it stop? My brother Tony Cooks was a bail bondsman. Shot down by the police, killed the wrong man. He called 911 for backup at the minimal. They saw his black skin, assumed he was the criminal. Jordan Davis was on Bay Meadows and Southside. At the gas station, music playing outside. Drunk man parked at the store to take his wife. Got offended and figured that he should take his life. Mike Brown was just walking down the street, man, and got stopped by a Ferguson policeman. They pulled the guns and told him to put his hands up. He put them in the air and still they shot that man up. Ezell Moore was harassed by the gang squad. Shot while he was lying down, that seemed kinda odd. They know he had some mental issues he was dealing with. His mama came to console him, they pulled the nightsticks. They trading whips for guns, hoods for badges. Leave no room for my people to make advances. We ain't got no advantages to get our freedom. Nowadays any nigga think they f***ing free is dumb. If we don't get out, if we don't rant and rave, we gon' be in the same position, we gon' die a slave.
No matter what you do, don't you die a slave.
All right, welcome back. That's A Brother Like Ezell. And that piece is, it's just a beautiful, very powerful piece that I thought was really important to play in the wake of everything that's been happening over this last couple of weeks. All right, and it's a piece by Georgia M. Muldrow, Moses West, and Ill Clinton. And this is a collaborative song, and it's a dedication to all those suffering from oppression and violence at the hand of a racist system. Ezell Ford and others in this song lost their lives for no good reason. So check this piece out. Again, it's A Brother Like Ezell, by Georgia Ann Muldrow, Moses West, and Ill Clinton. And I thought that was really appropriate for our next segment of the show. Joining us now to talk about what's going on in Ferguson and nationally is Larry Everest, a writer for Revolution newspaper, who has been in Ferguson since before they decided not to indict the cop that murdered Michael Brown. Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Good to be with you.
Well, like I said, you've been in Ferguson since just before the announcement of no indictment. And in the first piece that you wrote, you described the scene that night when they announced the no indictment as waiting through 30 minutes of torment to get kicked in the stomach. Let's talk about what it was like when that announcement was made.
Well, you know, look, the people of Ferguson have been twisting in the wind or being twisted in the wind by the state for 108 days. There was enough evidence to indict Darren Wilson, who murdered Michael Brown, within a day, within hours, perhaps. And of course, we know if the tables had been turned or if it had been a black youth accused of this kind of some sort of a shooting, it would have been minutes. So for 108 days, there's been this charade of due process and legality. And one of the things I learned here, even before the night of the verdict, was just how much torment and agony not just the murder had created, but then this whole elongated, extended effort by the state at all levels, Obama on down, to delay this and to get the pig off without any charges. And one black mother of six children, told me that there were nights she just couldn't sleep between that kind of agony of feeling. If there was not an indictment, her children had no future in this country at all, that they were subject to being executed anytime, any place. And she also described never having felt so angry and upset and outraged. And she's somebody that's been out protesting. She went to the dialogue between Bob Avakian and Cornel West. But her story of her, just the deep pain this has caused, is shared by thousands and tens of thousands and millions of people. So on that night, what was so outrageous is Monday about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, we got word the decision was going to be announced. And they wouldn't even give a time when it was going to be. Later, after 4 or 5 hours, it turned out it was going to be at 8 o'clock at night. So we were all gathered out there, very cold, kind of damp night. There were 600-700 people out there. And everybody was, you know, there'd been a lot of chanting and a lot of spirit out there. But at 8 o'clock, everybody went quiet to try to hear. Somebody was up on a car and was relaying what was being said. And they went on for 30 minutes before they even said what was going to happen. It was like they put people through that final torment of standing there on pins and needles with your stomach tied in knots before then they delivered this gut punch in the stomach. And, you know, Leslie McSpadden, Michael Brown's mom just broke down, and what did I do wrong? What did I do wrong? Michael Brown's stepfather. You know, this is when he exploded in rage, burn it down, in righteous rage, burn it down, burn it down. And then people protested, stayed there and protested. And when people tried to march down the street, they were confronted with some of these big, what do you call it, anti-personnel or anti-riot vehicles. It looks like a giant semi, practically, with tear gas and different kind of weapons on the top and so on. And it wasn't even an hour before they had declared this an illegal assembly, maybe because somebody threw a water bottle that hit the ground someplace.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. It wasn't even an hour, and this was after I was at the press conference where the governor and the mayor of St. Louis and the different police officials were saying, no, we're going to give people a chance to nonviolently express their protest, and that was just a lie. And then they started firing tear gas into the crowd. And I went up to try to take pictures, took some pictures of it and got a lung full of this, you know, and it makes you feel like, I mean, I knew what it was, but if you didn't know, you'd think you were going to suffocate to death, you know, because you can't breathe. And meanwhile, this was all going down about 9:15 to 10 o'clock, you know, and it's not like people left, they didn't. But we took a look over it on West Florissant, which is a street parallel, maybe a mile over, which was the site of the first resistance after Michael Brown was murdered. That's right near the Canfield Apartments where Michael Brown was from and where he was shot down. And over there, people were just pouring into that street and, you know, expressing their rage, basically, probably, I would guess, over 1,000 people driving in, walking in, just as we said in an excellent article at RevCom, which I encourage people to read, in defense of the fighters of Ferguson, letting the world know in no uncertain terms that they were saying, hell no, and they just were not going to put up with this, and there was no hope for any kind of change within this system.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Larry Everest. Larry is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and he's the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda, and he is in St. Louis. He's in Ferguson these days, covering the aftermath of the heinous decision by the St. Louis County Grand Jury to not indict Officer Darren Wilson, the cop that murdered Michael Brown in cold blood and did it so the whole world could see.
You know, one of the things that I thought was really, really very important, and it's kind of heavy because, you know, there was a state of emergency before they brought down the news of the non-indictment. There was, you know, they brought in thousands of National Guard troops. You know, they have all of this stuff going on. But something happened this time. There's something very different that happened this time in terms of people refusing to be funneled into ritualized protest aimed at putting a few Band-Aids on the sores. You know, they actually, their rage was not, you know, it was palpable as you're watching what people were doing and what they were going through, what they were saying, what they were doing. You know, that seemed to be a very significant thing. And I was curious about that because, you know, in the past, you know, the bootlickers in August, the bootlickers they brought out from every corner of society down there and every corner of the country, they brought these people out to sort of try and put a blanket on top of things. And I'm wondering, like, this thing was very different in a certain sense, where people just refused and proudly refused and said, we're not going to lay down.
Well, yeah, you know, one thing, I mean, you should know, and this is in one of the dispatches I sent, is that the state authorities said we had no idea. We underestimated the outpouring of rage. But it begins with a story from the mother that I talked to, the black woman that I talked to. And I think it's that kind of feeling deep, deep in your core of your being that this system is just murdering us and they're not going to give us any justice at all. And the kind of searing pain and hurt that has been expressed to me by many different people, from younger people to older middle-aged people, just that enough is enough and things have just reached a point where, as she said, there's no future. And I think people are capturing the slow genocide that's going on. I heard one person I heard out there said, yeah, the youth and other people took the actions they did on West Florissant because they know they're just killing us. You know, they're just killing us. So I think it is that that has really lit up the sky, so to speak, and politically, and summoned so many people to wake up. But one thing I do want to make clear, and look, again, being out there on West Florissant, these are people the system has cast out. There's a whole system of debt peonage they ensnare people here with. The people have been shunted to the lowest rungs of society and face abuse after abuse after abuse. And that's who was out there. But I do want to say that there's very broad and diverse kinds of protest here. It's a very broad kind of mix of people. There are some protests that are strictly nonviolent or strictly within legal limits. There are other protests that are more along the lines of civil disobedience, like nonviolently marching up and blocking the 44 freeway, as was done the day after, I believe it was, the verdict. And then even as you go further out than that, I mean, I talked to people in some churches before this happened, and I don't think these folks were going to get out in the street, but this profoundly impacted them. One woman was saying, no, we've got to keep everything peaceful. And then she went on to tell me a story. It's a black woman at one of the churches, of how angry she got when she saw the police taking down license plate numbers outside their church, and she went out and confronted them. So this runs deep, but it's a very, you know, it's a broad, complex mix of things. But I think you're pointing to the core of it that's really driving it in the most overall sense. Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to bring Amina from the Revolution Club in L.A. to talk about a few minutes on what's going on in L.A. and some of the plans for protests continuing. And people, you know, people should really go and check Larry's articles out at revcom.us. It's a really whole different ball game when you're looking to understand what's happening in Ferguson. So we're going to bring Amina on for a couple minutes, and you can stick around and maybe you'll be able to jump in at some point, but I want to get a chance to talk with her a little bit, all right?
Good.
Okay.
I'll be here.
All right, man.
Yeah.
Amina, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
And
I should say very quickly, Amina is part of the Revolution Club here in Los Angeles, and you've been out in the streets all week long, and I know because I tried to call you, and it was always in the middle of So what's been going on?
So there's been nightly protests, both on college campuses and here throughout Los Angeles, from South Central Los Angeles, like MLK, the Crenshaw neighborhood, throughout the downtown LA area, and everything else in between. So there's been a lot of the hall of that Ferguson is everywhere, and really a defiant mood of the police brutality and the murder needing to come to a stop.
And, you know, part of the thing, I mean, this has been going on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. It's like, and you were among the people that were arrested, right?
Yes. I was part of the over 300 people who've been arrested in the city on Wednesday evening. And that was a lot of what's coming out is a lot of the illegality, I think, from some of what Larry was speaking to over just rounding up whole mass arrests. I think this has been the biggest arrest in any city compared to the entire country. So that's been a lot of what, but it still actually has brought a lot of people forward. I just read an article in the LA Times where a young woman speaks to, well, this has actually poured out more of my anger and my fury, and I'm determined to continue to stay in the street.
Yeah, yeah. And the point of actually, I remember when you were, I was talking with you about your experience in prison and other people who went to the jail overnight. And sort of this idea of there's something new on the streets is really, really important. And as well, you spent a lot of time out at UCLA and even there, this idea that there's something new that's taken hold of people since these developments in Ferguson.
Yeah, I think the very visceral anger that Larry was speaking to is very palpable, and it's actually spanned across a lot of different nationalities. I would say the UCLA demonstrations in particular have been a wide array of students who have really kind of stepped forward and said, I cannot believe that this is continuing to happen in a country like this, from black students saying, you know, I know the history of what it does for black people in this country, and I cannot look away from that. And from people of all different strata saying, this is enough, this is a breaking point, and I'm determined to stay out here with people. I'm determined to stay out in the streets because we've just had enough of this.
All right, Amina, thank you very much for joining us today. Larry?
Yeah.
Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll have you back as things continue to develop, all right?
Oh, hey, Michael. Okay.
All right, man. All right. Larry, take care.
Take care.
Yeah, and keep active, brother. All right? Keep writing. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Larry Everest, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and Amina, a member of the Revolution Club in Los Angeles, and we've been talking about the events in Ferguson and how it sparked off a whole new day across the country. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break, and we'll be right back with Bill Quigley, so stay tuned. That's The Clash with Revolution Rock, and we're going to go right into the interview I did with Bill Quigley a couple of days ago. So here it is. Just a few days ago, in fact, the day after the results of the grand jury whitewash came down in Ferguson, Missouri, I had the opportunity to speak with Bill Quigley. Bill is a law professor at Loyola University in New Orleans, and we spoke about his recent article in Counterpunch called Crackdown on the Constitution, 10 Illegal Police Actions to Watch for in Ferguson. It's something that all of us need to know about. Check this out. All right, in the wake of the decision by the grand jury in Missouri to not indict Darren Wilson, the cop who murdered Michael Brown, there's been a lot of righteous rage standing up against this kind of slap in the face to people everywhere, and especially to black people whose lives are being shown more and more every day to be meaningless for the system that rules over people. And as I was thinking about this, I remembered an article I read recently. And it's a piece called 10 Illegal Police Actions to Watch for in Ferguson. And it's written by Bill Quigley. And Bill is a law professor at Loyola University in New Orleans and has been somebody who's been actively involved in a lot of anti-repression activities all around the country over the last many numbers of years. So welcome to the show, Bill Quigley.
Thanks a lot, Michael. Glad to be part of it.
Let's talk about this, Bill. You talk about the First Amendment of the Constitution promises that the government will not abridge the freedom of speech or prevent the right of the people to peaceably assemble or to petition to the government for the redress of grievances. So what the hell's going on when they mount a small army to stop all this?
Well, it's as you say, it is something that most people who are involved in First Amendment activities are not that shocked about. But the police just declare the situation that it needs safety, it needs order, and they go ahead and take the steps that they want to take, and they blame it on outside agitators, they blame it on people who are interested in violence and that, and many of the times the police are the ones who actually start the violence. But the whole goal is just to stop people from protesting. Some of the tactics they use, people are used to. They, you know, they have false arrests where they'll just start arresting people. They'll just pick a couple of people and start arresting them, or they will, a tactic called kettling, which is a old-fashioned term for just circling up people and then just arresting everybody in that circle, even though they know that a lot of the people in that circle never did anything wrong and they're just peaceful protesters, but they just do it to try to take the wind out of our First Amendment rights to be able to protest. They use provocateurs. Often people are the most, in quotes, most radical people in the protest, close quotes, are police officers who are trying to encourage other people to do illegal things so that they can be identified and then snatched up by other police officers. But it's all about really about intimidation. And we see that in Ferguson. You've seen that in Los Angeles. We see that at all the political conventions. We see that after any time that people go ahead and take to the streets where they're dressed in Ninja Turtle outfits or somebody called Darth Vader outfits where they have shin guards and chest protectors and face shields and big guns and plastic flex cuffs and all that. And they're very okay with arresting anybody they feel like it because most of the times they don't have any identification on their uniform and they're not worried about being held accountable. There's no transparency or the like. We're seeing all of these things happening in Ferguson. I'm sure they're seeing plenty of these things happening in Los Angeles, Chicago, New Orleans, New York City, all the other places where people are protesting. Another thing they've been doing recently is they identify where the church or the storefront where people gather are safe houses or places for first aid or legal support or spiritual support, and they'll raid those places. They have big trucks, they got tanks, they got snipers, they arrest reporters. And then, of course, they use lots of weapons, everything from rubber bullets and wooden bullets to smoke bombs, flash bangs. And then what we saw so much last night in Ferguson is just hundreds and hundreds of canisters of tear gas. And all of this is just to make people shut up and get off the street.
Well, let me ask you this, Bill. There's a couple that I really wanted to zero in on at first, because there's things that people take for granted that what the cops are saying to them is actually true. And the first tactic that you lay out was kind of surprising for a lot of people when I went around and asked them, what do you think about this? If the cops come up to you and say this, do you think that you need to obey this? And that was the one talking about trying to stop people from protesting, saying that people can only protest until a certain time on a certain street or only if they keep moving. We're not there, not here, not now, no longer. And you say that that actually is unconstitutional. It's illegal for the police to do that. That, I think, would shock a lot of people.
Right. The police don't really understand the First Amendment. They don't follow it, and they certainly are not in favor of it. Their First Amendment is order. Their First Amendment is quiet. And we saw even yesterday or even this morning in Ferguson, the police saying, that sure didn't look like peaceful protest to me. Well, peaceful protest to the police and what peaceful protest is under the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't say you have to be quiet. Doesn't say you have to be polite. Constitution doesn't say that you have to keep moving. It doesn't say that you have to stay in this First Amendment pen. The Constitution doesn't say the police get to say you're on that side of the street or this side of the street. It doesn't get to say that you have to stop here and turn around. You're not allowed to go there. It says that the government shall make no laws infringing on our freedom of speech or our right to assembly. Now, everybody understands that if there is truly a situation of danger, then we would expect that the government would warn us of that and try to help us out. But most of the time, it's not that. It's just the inconvenience of the police officers. And they speak with authority. They believe they have that authority. They will back that authority up with force and overwhelming numbers. And as we say lots of times, you know, you cross those folks at your own peril because we have the Constitution, which is really powerful. They got guns. And in the short term, the guns are going to prevail over the Constitution. But in the long term, the Constitution is our protection here, and that's what most courts will end up saying. But they're not going to say it on the spot. They're going to say it later on. And people who really are vigorous in standing up for their right to protest, their right to demonstrate, their right to assemble and freedom of speech, you know, they run a real risk of being arrested.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Bill Quigley, a law professor at Loyola University in New Orleans, and we're talking about his recent article in Counterpunch magazine, Crackdown on the Constitution, 10 Illegal Police Actions to Watch for in Ferguson. You know, it's interesting because I remember one demonstration that was particularly heated, and I was in it. I was much younger, and one of the architects of the Vietnam War was speaking, and we just tore the place apart. We were not going to sit back and say, yeah, let this guy speak while they're, you know, mining the Haiphong Harbor, bombing Hanoi, all these things going on. And one of the things that happened when a bunch of us were arrested, there were, you know, they got people in the audience and everything else that were arrested. And one person was particularly passionate, arguing, this is unconstitutional. You've got to obey the Constitution. And the cop turned around and looked at him, smacked him across the face, sent him flying across the holding cell and said, the Constitution, grow up.
Yeah. Yeah, sadly. That's a great story to illustrate how the police and the authorities think about the Constitution. And that's why we have it. You know, if people think about it, we have these rights because people were standing up to an oppressive government. And they didn't think they were the oppressive government. They were standing up to England. They were standing up to Europe. They were standing up to people who they felt were trying to silence them and trying to tell them what to do. And that they thought it was very important to be able to have these freedoms. And those are freedoms that are recognized at least theoretically around the world. But as in the United States, a lot of places in this world, if you try to stand up and have freedom of speech, which is not just a constitutional right, but it's a human right at this point, the people who have the guns, the people who have the power, they will either actually or symbolically slap you across the face and say, are you kidding? We're in charge here.
Right, exactly. They're actually telling the truth. One thing I was going to ask is, I didn't realize that provocateurs were actually unconstitutional, use of provocateurs.
Well, what you have, it's not illegal for police to send undercover people into protests as observers. But what is illegal, and what police, whenever there actually is a trial for somebody who's arrested as a result of the actions of a provocateur, is that the police don't have the right to violate the law in order to supposedly protect the law. And what we find out usually with these police provocateurs is that they are the people who are in there saying, look, let's throw a bottle. Let's put lighter fluid on this car. Let's go get some guns and shoot at the police. Let's get some explosives. Let's do some Molotov cocktails. That is illegal for them to suggest that for other people. What usually happens, unfortunately, is that they pick the weakest, sometimes the most intellectually compromised people, and they will entrap them. They will encourage and push them into doing illegal activities. And as we have found out, when things are made public later, that the police will actually take illegal activities. They'll get so caught up in it that they will do those sorts of things. For example, you know, a lot of things that we used to think people were paranoid about, we realize that they're not paranoid at all. Like when people thought the police or the government was tapping their phones or looking at their emails and reading their letters, people, if you said that, people would say you're being paranoid. Now we know that's just day-to-day activity by the government. Same sort of thing people wondering about in terms of Ferguson, in terms of Los Angeles, in terms of Chicago, other places. You know, there's sometimes the people who are doing the most damage are actually seemingly much freer to move around than any other protester. And when everybody's arrested, they may be arrested, but they never show up in jail. And then when everybody goes to court, those people are not there, or they might show up as actually a witness. And the courts are not at all happy with police officers. Observing is fine, but provoking, creating crimes for people to participate in is generally recognized as illegal activity by the police. But often people are at such a disadvantage in these things and have done other things that they're not allowed to challenge them. But no, police breaking the law in order to capture some other people breaking the law is absolutely illegal.
Well, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Bill Quigley, a law professor at Loyola University in New Orleans, and we're talking about his recent article in Counterpunch magazine, Crackdown on the Constitution, 10 Illegal Police Actions to Watch for in Ferguson. Now, Bill, one thing, well, there's two here that kind of caught my eye. The thing around snatch squads, which if you could explain to people what that is, but that and false arrest, because, again, my long experience, I've been involved in things where literally up to maybe 80 people were arrested, and eventually when maybe 17 of them went to trial, the charges that were leveled against them were unidentified protester assaulted unidentified police officer with unidentified deadly weapon. It seemed just like Kafka world. It was sort of like, what the hell is going on? But actually, you're making a point here that this kind of stuff of false arrest, in these kind of mass arrest, false arrest, snatch squads that are very regular occurrences in demonstrations, particularly the more intense the demonstrations are, the more these kinds of things happen. And again, I didn't know that that was actually unconstitutional. I thought they could just say, look, we figured that these people were responsible. We went after them.
Well, it is a tactic, as you said earlier. Police, when they're training for these things, they don't say this is constitutional and this is not. What they say is, one of the jobs of the police is to identify who are the leaders. who are the legal observers, who are the reporters, who are the videographers, et cetera, et cetera. And we being the police, want to try to remove those people from the scene. And so they will, they train in this snatch and grab where there is a, like a flying wedge of police officers who somebody will identify, let's go get the guy in the white sweatshirt and the guy in the red hat, because they're really leading a lot of the chants. They seem to be some of the ringleaders. If we take them out, maybe the rest of the crowd will go away. And so they will actually dive into the crowd with this flying wedge, with guns up, with pepper spray, with gas, lights, the whole thing, grab the people they have identified, pull them out of the crowd and arrest them and take them away as an intimidation activity. And what you find out, as you say, in these sorts of things, they'll arrest. In Ferguson, before last night, they'd arrested 400 people. You know how many people had gone to trial? This is several months, starting in August. They arrested 400 people. Not a single person had gone to trial. So the expectation is that 300 to maybe 350 people will never go to trial. Those are tactical arrests where they don't care whether people are actually prosecuted. They don't care whether they have the evidence to convict them. They think for the preservation of order that these individuals should be taken out of the protest, and so they will do that. They'll plan on that. They will do it. They'll do it in such a way that you can't identify necessarily who the police officers are who do that, and that false arrest is just something for the, you know, the city attorney or the prosecutor to deal with later, and most people are thrilled that the case is dropped and don't do anything about it. There are people who file suit. We just finished a thing in New York City from the 2004 Republican National Convention where the city had to pay over $10 million, I believe, for something like 1,600 people who were falsely arrested. Police just blocked off one end of the street, blocked off the other end of the street, and arrested every single person in that block. And did they do that thinking that those people had violated the law? No, of course not. They did it to try to intimidate people, to try to scare people, and try and stop people from exercising their First Amendment rights.
One more question on this, and I do really recommend people check this article out. The thing, the use of chemical and other weapons, you know, again, that's something that people's sort of just the conventional knowledge, conventional wisdom says to people, well, look, we don't like this and we'll fight against it, but it doesn't come up in people's mind that the use of things like tear gas, pepper gas, those kinds of things are actually, they're breaking the law when they use them.
Yeah, the police are not allowed to try to inflict pain on anybody, ever. That is not their job. They are not constitutionally allowed to inflict pain. Punishment only happens to individuals who are convicted. They are allowed to arrest and detain people for whom they have probable cause, but just firing tear gas into crowds of people when they know that 95% of the people in that crowd haven't committed any crime, haven't done anything wrong, but they're just doing it to either try to scare off a few people or they're just tired of people being in this particular place. That is the intentional infliction of pain by police officers. They do it all the time, but there is no legal basis for them to be able to do that. In fact, chemical weapons, tear gas and the like, are outlawed under international law. You can't, you're not supposed to use those things even in war in various places. And so you saw anybody who watched television, watched the Ferguson stuff. I mean, there are hundreds of canisters of tear gas just thrown into areas where the police hear some breaking of glass or they see that a couple of people are rocking a police car and they'll fire 5, 10, 15, 20 tear gas canisters to disperse hundreds of people, most all of whom are doing nothing illegal at all. And that is not authorized by law and is therefore illegal.
All right, Bill Quigley, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you, Michael, sure. And congratulations to you all in Los Angeles for raising hell for justice.
There you go. And the same back to you, man. Take care, Bill.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Bill Quigley. Bill is a professor of law at Loyola University in New Orleans, and we've been talking about his article, 10 Illegal Police Actions to Watch For in Ferguson. All right, welcome back. And that was, as I said, that was Bill Quigley. And, you know, one of the things I think we all really got to think about in light of today's program, there's a whole hell of a lot going on in the world, and the world is a very different place right now. It's very different than it was 3, 4 weeks ago, a month ago. You know, we have people who are out righteously struggling around all this, around against all this oppression, whether it be in Mexico, be here in Ferguson, or anywhere. People are standing up against this rotten, man-eating, person-eating system that we live under. And it's imperative that people continue to actually really take up that kind of struggle, but also to look into deeper questions and to begin to examine why is it that this is happening and what we can do about it. And one of the things I would really encourage everyone to do,
go to revcom.us. That's right, revcom.us. And there you can find all kinds of answers to the questions that are dogging you day in and day out these days, all right? Questions about how to change this world and bring on a whole new world. And in particular, check out the dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. You can see the whole dialogue there on the site, so don't miss that, all right? And become part of the movement for revolution.
This is what's really dramatically, importantly, majorly needed today, all right?
All right, well, that just about wraps up another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Ruben Martinez, a journalist, author, and musician, and a professor in literature at Loyola Marymount. I also want to thank Larry Everest, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and Amina, a member of the LA Revolution Club. I also want to thank Bill Quigley. Bill is a professor of law at Loyola Law School in New Orleans. And I want to thank my assistant producer today, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer for today, Federico Garcia, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going out now with Everything But the Truth from Lucinda Williams. Check this out.